You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
Succeeding at being a popular musician requires the work of dozens of people behind the scenes. A musician like John Mayer, for instance, a mainstream chart-topping artist who is constantly reaching for new heights in his craft, has a team of multitudes behind him. Lawyers, promoters, venue bookers, agents, not to mention the hundreds of others who try to pitch opportunities, collaborations, and endorsement deals, and the millions of fans, for that matter, who have an increasingly close interaction with the artist through social platforms like Twitter and Facebook.
How did they find me here? What do they want from me? All of these vultures hiding right outside my door.
Of all the voices surrounding a popular artist, sometimes the closest is that of their manager. This week, we actually spoke to the guy who manages John Mayer and a number of other artists like Ray LaMontagne, Brett Denon, and The Walkmen. Michael McDonald broke into the professional music world as a tour manager for the Dave Matthews Band in the 90s. In 2000, he co-founded with Dave Matthews ATO Records, who released albums by Radiohead, Crowded House, and My Morning Jacket, among others. Shortly thereafter, he founded Mick Management, a boutique artist management company. I asked Michael about what it is a manager does in comparison to the hundreds of others who surround an artist.
You're the point of contact to the artist. And the idea is, or at least my idea, my philosophy is that, you know, it's my job to leave artists in a creative environment for, you know, as much of their daily life as possible. You know, I think very few artists have been able to manage the business of things and while maintaining, you know, a level of creativity that, you know, sort of got them to that place. With commercial opportunities, endorsement opportunities, you know, writing for film or playing with a symphony or renegotiating a deal, those are all things that are done that I do. I spend weeks negotiating and then I'll take my progress back to my artist, check in with them. We'll review it, sometimes decide to tweak some things, whatever. I'll go back, negotiate some more, go back to the artist, etc. So as opposed to them negotiating or networking or that sort of thing when they, you know, I think are oftentimes better served by, you know, writing or recording or just living life such that they're getting their inspiration for whatever they're going to do next.
We've spoken to a few artists who part of what they do as an artist has changed over the last 10 or 15 years. They are doing the things like you're saying, and like being able to focus on the recording, but they're also sort of branched off with a lot of kind of direct communications with fans, and blogging and tweeting and these kinds of things. Is that something that you also, as a manager, have a part in?
It depends. If there are artists that, you know, that comes easily to, or that's a priority for them and that's something they want to do, then by all means they communicate directly with their fans. Far be it from me to say I can do it better than the actual artist. But there are other artists for whom that doesn't come easily, or that's not a real interest of theirs or a strength of theirs. And so we do that out of our office. I never do it in a voice that people could mistake as the artist. I mean, it's very, you know, it's clearly done on behalf of the artist. But I have, you know, probably 50-50 in terms of artists that do it directly, you know, and artists that we communicate for. Obviously, if we're communicating on behalf of the artist, it's far less frequently and, you know, much more informational oftentimes than those artists who are tweeting what they had for dinner and what they're doing tonight.
Yeah, one of the artists in your stable, John Mayer, has been one of the more active ones I've seen out on, you know, the social media space.
He has been, and he actually, I'm trying to think when it was. It was the end of the last album or touring cycle, sometime last September or something. You know, he stopped tweeting and doesn't post nearly as much on his Tumblr site as he used to. from the get-go, he, you know, from the time I started managing him 11 years ago, he's been really involved in you know, in the online space in terms of, that was, you know, a huge motive, you know, the early days of communicating with fans and building a, defining an image and a path and a style. He was definitely one of the early adopters, and was really, really aggressive on Twitter. It's an amazing tool. There's no better way to really amass all those thoughts that you have throughout the day that may be interesting to the millions of people that are following you. What happened with him, which I think is sort of funny, is, and one of the reasons he stopped was that he said he started thinking in 140 character spurts.
I can see that could actually affect your songwriting in a way.
Well, yeah, it's real short songs. You know, that was one of the things, you know, where he just said, this is, it's getting to be a little bit too much. You know, and I think also he's always been one to sort of be at the forefront of a movement, and his Twitter sort of caught on. I think he felt like there was another frontier, which is Tumblr. He made the move over there.
Was that analogous to kind of like what he did as he was just starting out as an artist, you know, non-social media-wise? Because I remember when he was starting out, he was kind of one of the early people involved in setting up street teams and really just, you know, working with their fans to make them feel that they're included and involved.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been a huge priority for him and for us. And it's not that, you know, just sort of only use the newest and shiniest toy. I think what we've been, and sometimes we've sort of overshot it in terms of we've gotten onto something too early, you know, such that it would have been much more impactful had we waited 6 months or something. But
do you have an example of that?
We made all these iPod cases one summer. It was the summer that the iPod had come out, and you know, I think when you live in a major market, you know, but particularly on one of the coasts, and maybe more so in New York, because you could see everyone with their white headphones hanging out of their ears, you assume that everyone has an iPod. And so we had this large quantity of iPod cases, and we went out and realized that most people didn't have iPods. So it wasn't a very big seller that summer. But nevertheless, we you know, put them in our online store and they sold. But you know, we always want to keep improving on how we communicate and how we interact with fans. Whether that be we move from Twitter to Tumblr to try that, and we move, you know, whatever the next one is, we try to remain as big of a name as he's become, and as big of as other artists of ours have come. We always want to remain nimble enough to be able to, but also never afraid to try something new.
How do you judge the success of using one of these new techniques, one of these new platforms? And how do you decide, okay, well, this, I mean, obviously with the iPod cases, you guys figured out just through how you're able to get them out the door, but if you're doing something like Twitter or Tumblr.
Right. Now, having a truckload of iPod cases was a very clear, clear result. It's not always graphable. I think you used to be able to see it much more easily, you know, whether it was through record sales or et cetera. But, I mean, I think what we have done is extrapolated ideas from very small samplings of people, of fans, and assumed that they were relevant to the wider fan base. And I think we've been right most times. For example, prior to the last album release, we did a surprise show in Los Angeles, and John tweeted about it, you know, that at like noon, and said, I'm playing at the Troubadour tonight, you know, tickets, you can start getting tickets at 4 o'clock or something. So, you know, pretty quickly there was a line around the block, around the corner. You know, as we went and talked to people in line, we realized that many of them, it wasn't, you know, some of them certainly heard about it through Twitter, but a large sampling of them heard about it from Pandora. You know, we were all familiar with Pandora, but never really knew, again, the penetration that it had, or at least its relevance to our fan base. And so as a result, we reached out to Pandora, and one of the biggest aspects of our album release campaign was, certainly one of our biggest online initiatives was with Pandora. And we really invested a lot of time and assets into Pandora. And it worked out. We sold more records. I think we sold more records this first week than we did the prior release, which was, you know, as you know, two or three years prior and 15% better. So statistically, from trend-wise, we weren't supposed to sell more than we did last time, and we did. Was it Pandora? I don't know. But I think as we lose other avenues to sort of rise above the clutter and the sort of the noise, how do you stand out? I think you have to try more innovative things that are based at least in some part with an experience that you have that it's relevant to your artist.
I think there's like a question of hindsight question, a question we might be able to answer better in 5 or 10 years than we are now. But there's a perspective of like the history of music that things are completely different now than they used to be. Back in, you know, before the internet, the industry was a lot more predictable. And you did not have to experiment and throw out as much and necessarily, you know, waste as much time on, you know, on doing these things because it was a little bit more textbookish.
Right.
Is that a correct perspective? Have things really changed?
I think it's interesting. I think it's really easy to say yes, and it's all changed. And you used to just be able to do X, Y, Z, and it was a hit. The reality is there were, you know, it was much easier to say, all right, we got K-Rock, we got MTV, we got a Rolling Stone cover. We've got Saturday Night Live. You know, arguably, well, you know, if you had those, you were golden. But I think, you know, the idea that there were fewer gatekeepers, you know, there were fewer gatekeepers. Now I feel like there aren't gatekeepers. But there certainly were a few gatekeepers that if you got in, if they sort of blessed you, you were pushed forth and you had a really good chance. The reality is there were also a lot of failures in those days as well. It wasn't, you know, were there a lot of things that never got on K-Rock that became hits. I still think good music with, you know, with all the basic building blocks of, you know, hit songs, great performances, you know, an interesting artist, well-managed, you know, label, everyone doing their part, working hard together in unison, pulling in the same direction. You had a good shot then, and you've still got a good shot now. I mean, the result is that you may sell fewer records, or that you're likely to sell fewer records if you have a hit. But I think we're judging things differently now. You know, the Decemberists were the number one album with 100,000 records. You know, and the Decemberists, they're going to go on to sell, I don't know, if they have a gold record or they sell 350,000 records, whatever. The Decemberists are still a big band. They're all making a living doing it. They're all professional musicians with great careers. I think where we miss out on the high end, we're never going to have Diamond Records again, 10 million copies. But I still think a hit is still a hit, and hard work is still hard work. And, you know, where it has shifted a little bit now is I think the onus is more on the artists in many respects than it used to be. Most successful artists these days participate in their career. And what I mean by that is they don't show up, walk on stage, and disappear. And, you know, you never see or hear from them other than when they're on stage or on the radio or on TV. There's a lot more to it these days than that. And I think that's the element of mystery makes history is gone because we just have that much more access to everyone's life. I have more access to your life than I ever had before, you know. Forget if you're a public figure, everyone's got more access. But I really think, you know, the days of the way you broke a record and the end result, you know, record sales is undeniably dramatically different today than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and 20 years ago. But I also think what I think doesn't change is the fact that a hit's a hit and, you know, good quality music will find a place in the world.
Do you think that it's easier for an artist to find a niche and to just really nurture that niche at the expense of maybe, you know, having a hit record career of going on and, you know, being on hit radio. And maybe, you know, maybe with an eye for that, maybe hit radio is disappearing and the niche artist is the new thing, like the way it's going to be.
For better or worse, what technology has done is, you know, provided us with unlimited channels, not just television or radio, but just in general, channels for, you know, media channels, information channels, channels of influence, etc. It used to be in most markets, there were, sort of in my world, there's a AAA station, there's a Hot AC station, there's a Top 40 station, there's a modern rock station. Not only does that not exist anymore, it does in some markets, obviously. There are still some great radio markets, but, you know, now you have satellite radio where people who never had a prayer of being on any one of those four stations in a market can now be heard. You now have a way to communicate with your niche fan base. In answer to your question, I think it is. And it's like there's still a cycle of commerce. It just flows very differently than it used to be in art. That used to just happen when you'd get a check from your record label, you'd make a record, put a little cash in your pocket, you know, sell records, your fans would buy the records. Sooner or later, you'd, you know, hopefully see a check from the label. It's just a different cycle, but it's, you know, the same. It's still an artist connecting with a fan, and the fan literally investing in that artist by spending their money, helping them make a record, going to see them live, you know, or otherwise supporting them.
How do you find music that you're currently getting into? Like, what's an artist or a group that you're currently into, and how have you found them outside of, you know, kind of a work context?
To be honest, and I have no affiliation with Pandora. I've learned that I'm a big Modest Mouse fan from Pandora. I usually find bands. I'll spend more time with a band after the hype, and as a result, I've sort of, in, you know, the last 4 years, fallen in love with Arcade Fire, fallen in love with Death Cab for Cutie, Spoon. None of these are revolutionary, you know, in terms of what's, you know, hot and new. But, you know, rarely do I hear something on the radio that I don't already know what it is. But that's, I mean, it's difficult to take yourself out of sort of an industry person, you know, and I can cheat and fill my office with kids in their early 20s who keep feeding me great music.
Those are the, you know, the taste makers, the taste predictors, the young ones.
Yeah. I mean, they are, I can't pretend to be the cutting edge. You know, I never really was. But, I mean, I think even, you know, my tastes, and I've always sort of gravitated toward, you know, what I thought was great music, and I've never thought of my tastes as all that unique. You know, and ultimately most of what I like is pretty mainstream.
But I want to thank you for your time today. Thanks for coming on Radio Berkman.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
Michael McDonald is the founder of the boutique artist management company, Mick Management. The Rethink Music Conference is coming up on April 25th in Boston. This episode has been part of a series of podcasts about the future of music leading up to the conference. You can find out more about that at rethink-music.com or visit our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with help from Amr Asher, Chris Babbitts, and Alan Bargfried from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.